about the Pamela anomalies. It's not a topic I'm working on usually, galactic cosmic rays, but I think it's of interest to most of us because the implication of this observation might be very interesting. For those of you who are not familiar with the Pamela anomaly, Pamela is a satellite measuring a flux of antimatter cosmic rays. Among other things, it measured the ratio of the flux of positrons to electrons as a function of energy, and found out that above an energy of about 10 GeV, there is a rise in this ratio. So there is more more positrons per electrons as you go with energy. And this is in contrast to the standard model. And therefore, it is known as a Pamela anomaly. And there are many solutions suggested in order to solve this this anomaly. According to Igor Moskalenko, there are hundreds of papers, literally, explaining this anomaly. So what I will try to do is to give a not so biased, so slightly biased review of the subject. It's slightly biased because, well, I have my own opinion. I also have one of these models suggested, work which I did in collaboration with Nir Shaviv and Tzvi Piran, which should appear soon in Physics of Letters. But I will try to give you the taste of the subject, and also to ask the question, do we need a primary source of positrons, which, as I will show, was one of the main suggestions to solve this this issue. So first, I will give a quick partial description of the main observations of galactic cosmic rays, just to refresh your memory and to give the main constraints that we have on this type of model. Then I will describe the main features of the standard models, a group of standard models, the main features and what are the predictions of these models to the ratio of positrons to electrons and for the spectrum of electrons. And I will also I will confront it, of course, with the observations, and we'll see that there is a discrepancy. Then I will describe different classes of solutions to this discrepancy, putting a lot of emphasis on the different solutions which do not require a new source of positrons, describing into somewhat more detail the model that we proposed. And at the end, I will conclude. So what are the main observations? Of course, we have the spectrum of cosmic rays. We are interested mostly in the region of about GeV, to say 100 GeV, about TeV, where the spectrum is dominated by protons, and it roughly goes like the energy to the minus 2.7. Another very valuable observation is the ratio of secondaries, stable secondaries, to primaries. The main measurement here is done by boron to carbon, mostly because boron is only a secondary. It's easier to measure at these since the difference in charge and mass between these elements is easier to measure. And what is measured here, basically, when we look at the number of secondaries observed, in a mostly model-independent, not entirely, but mostly model-independent way, is a grammage. So what is the amount of mass column density that a given cosmic ray is crossing on the way to Earth, or not on the way to Earth, sorry, before it escapes the galaxy. And you can see here different lines of grammage. These are the observations. They are better at lower energies. They are becoming worse as you go to higher and higher energies with very large error bars around about 100 GeV. And these are the different grammage as a function of energy. And you can see that we have a typical cosmic ray with about 1 GeV per nucleon crosses about 10 grams per centimeter square of material on the way to Earth. And secondaries, of course, are produced by interactions of the cosmic rays with the matter that they cross. Now, this is giving us only column density, so distance times density, mass density. We do not know how much time these particles spend before they arrive to us. In order to have some constraints on the time, it's possible to use the unstable secondaries to primaries. Here, the most useful element is a beryllium-10. it is most useful first because it's produced only by secondary products of the cosmic rays, and second because the half lifetime is about 1.5 million years, which is rather similar to the time that that cosmic rays, or the closest to the time that cosmic rays spend in the galaxy. So it gives us some probe on this time. These measurements, or the measurement of the time that particles spend in the galaxy, is more model dependent than the grammage that I just showed before. But in most models, the best observations are between, say, about 100 MeV and about GeV, and this is constraining the time scale to be about 20 mega years at GeV. So a particle, a GeV cosmic ray, spend about 20 million years in the galaxy before it escapes. It travels about 10 grams per centimeter square, and this is giving us an average density of about a fraction of particle per centimeter cube. Now, the uncertainty here is rather large, about 50%. So it can be 30, it can be 10, it may even be 40. Rather large uncertainty in this part. Sure. Well, you talk about the fact. Yeah, of course. This is in the rest frame, of course. This is in the rest frame.
But if you show that the particles don't really lose energy, they either escape or they make it or they are transferred, or
Energy loss is included in the models, of course, and they are more prominent for lower energy particles and for higher energy particles, but they are included. Well, you have, this is a rigidity dependent scale. So one thing is the fact that you go like the momentum. Here you become relativistic. So it, and a few things. One thing is that you're supposed to have some break just by the fact that here you become relativistic. Second, yes. At this part, we are affected by the solar wind because the particles, when we measure them, of course, on Earth, they are climbing the potential of the solar wind, which is somewhere between 100 MeV and, say, can be a GeV. It's modulating. So it's... well, I'm actually probably for beryllium to carbon, it wouldn't make a difference here. But in other measurements, it is important. Here, I guess it's mostly the fact that you're going from one to another. If in most models, by the way, most diffusion models, if you do not add some additional component to the diffusion, there needed to be some break here. Okay? So there need to be some break here. Or some other scale which is coming here to explain. So it's not entirely explained just by intuitive facts. And we don't know why there is a break in the diffusion, if there is one, if there is a break in the diffusion. Is there any effect for the sun here? This, no.
Mm-hmm.
I see. Anti-proton spectrum. So this is a spectrum of antiprotons to protons, the ratio. No, this is actually the flux of antiprotons. The peak is around a few GeV. This, I'm showing this mostly to show that there is no strong flux above 10 GeV. It's mostly important for dark matter models, and the antiprotons are most likely secondary. So they fit quite well the idea that these are produced by interaction of cosmic rays with the interstellar medium. Anisotropy. Cosmic rays are mostly isotropic. The anisotropy level is very low. It's rather difficult to measure anisotropy. It's possible only at high energies between, here they're measuring between 1 TeV and say about 10 to the 3 TeV. I'm not sure about all the methods to measure these anisotropies, but some of the methods are using the fact that the movement of the Earth to look for difference in the flux observed. So you see here that the anisotropy level is about 10 to the minus 3. It seems like it's not so much energy dependent, which is counterintuitive to most diffusion models, but still it can be accommodated with the error bars. And the peak flux, so what this anisotropy is on the level of, in this half of the hemisphere we have more than in this half of the hemisphere, and the more is coming actually from the anti-galactic center and not from the galactic center. Roughly. Okay.
The only way that I'm aware of when people in diffusion models have been able to accommodate this is by taking into account the discreteness in the sources that make bumps appear in the anisotropy bumps.
Yeah.
This was discussed in the 90s by the accelerator. I think there is some work, recent work, even more recent work in 2006 by Vladimir.
It's easy, yeah. If you add discrete.
The problem is twofold. One is that in diffusion models, that plot should show a growing, a monotonically growing function with the same slope as the Born-Oberkappel ratio, roughly. And
which is not so well constrained at this level.
What?
Yeah. But at this range, we don't have any handle on what happened. So naively, you would expect it to go up. Yeah, is there roughly between e to the 0.3 to e to the 0.6 or 0.7. It's a fair, no. It's just the first.
Okay.
There's also a lot of uncertainty. This may depend strongly. Yeah. How much? I think that this will also be depending strongly on the local structure of the magnetic field. Not so much. Okay.
What I infer is actually that these energies, the confinement volume is enormous.
Much larger than expected.
Very much larger. But the only way I can think of it, frankly, the only way to get the anisotropy down is to have a very, very large scattering volume.
Well, not only that, but it should be almost like 10 or
Another source of information is a gamma ray galactic background. I will not talk a lot about it, but this is, here we have, it's not only a local measurement, we have measurement over the whole galactic plane, different latitudes, and in principle, these measurements giving us some information about the electron population, about the proton population, about the gas distribution in the galaxy. You need to disentangle all of them in the measurement. It's not trivial, but there is a wealth of information. This is what the model predicts. This is the observations by EGRET, known as the EGRET axis, which made a lot of troubles to modelers. And as far as I know, Fermi just have shown that the axis is a observational error or effect, nothing to do with real background. And actually now I think that everything falls nicely on what one would expect, at least when you take an integration of everything. When you actually try to explain specific structures, you need to go to much more detail in your models, much farther than everything that we are. I'm not sure. I just gave it for illustration. These are different. I'm not sure what is exactly anyone, but these are contribution of different components. So electrons, pions, So different components all together, and this is what you should get. I'm not sure what is exactly each one. But it's a model. It's a specific model. So what are the main conclusions one can get from what I've shown here? So cosmic rays are trapped in the galaxy in a rigidity-dependent way. We know it just because of the grammage. The grammage decreases.
The first statement is true at GED energies.
Yeah.
The other okay. Gives you a completely different
the grammage decreases at higher rigidities, again, where we can measure them. One GeV cosmic ray spend about 20 million years and count about 10 grams of matter, and we need to explain it. So this is what we measure. And there are many CR sources. Okay? We cannot explain to use one or two, three different sources by the fact that we have this the low anisotropy.
Sorry, can I just add a caveat on point three as well?
This one.
Strictly speaking, much of the distinction, the cosmic rays we see arriving near the Earth at these
points. Okay. I agree.
Okay.
Oh, it depends on this one. It depends.
1.01.
Yeah. Well, you can lose more energy if you're going to heavier elements. But so what is the standard model? What the group of standard models assume the following. First, they assume a largely uniform CR source distribution in the galaxy. So there is some structure on galactic level, more near the center, less far from the center, more in the disk, some distributions go above the disk. Each one of the sources here is giving us a power loss spectrum for the cosmic rays. The cosmic rays propagate in the galaxy in a diffusive way with the rigidity-dependent diffusive, mostly considered to be as a energy to some power. I mark it here beta. And since I'm talking only on protons, electrons, and positrons, and relativistic ones, I interchange between energy and rigidity here. Okay? But for proton, electron, and positrons that are relativistic, it goes like this energy. Cosmic rays diffuse in the halo with some scale height. which is much larger than the Z-scale height. It's of the orders of kiloparsecs. And once they get to some distance, to the scale height, they can escape. So if this is a scale height, we have here a particle starting. It's diffusing, reaching to the scale height and escaping, and we do not see it anymore. This is a basic model. And we can have some additions to this model, like a wind, reacceleration, turbulence. These are mostly effective at lower energies. When you go to higher energies, 10 GeV, 100 GeV, there is no much difference between the different models. And we can stay only with these main assumptions. In principle, the model give a reasonable fit to the data. There is a wealth of data, mostly from different elements and different secondaries, stable, unstable. There is a reasonable agreement. The typical parameters are the diffusion coefficient at an energy of about a few GeV is found to be a few times 10 to the 28 centimeters squared per second. The slope of this beta of the diffusion 0.3 to 0.6. In some models, it can be 0.7, even 0.8. And the scale height is a few kiloparsecs, say 2 to 4. So, what are the predictions for electrons and positrons in this model? We have the source giving us some power law, e to the minus alpha. Now, what we observe on Earth in this model is simply the production rate times the duration over which cosmic rays reside in the galaxy. This is depending on the diffusion, goes like e to the minus beta. So the slope we observe on Earth is simply the slope at the source minus beta. For electrons, there is a point where cooling time becoming shorter than the escape time, and then the cooling time is what defining the time over which particles are accumulated. So instead of minus beta that we lose here, we lose actually minus 1. Usually beta is smaller than 1. So it's e to the minus alpha minus 1. What about positrons? The source of the positrons in the usual model is the secondaries of the protons. So this distribution of protons in the galaxy, this is a source for the positrons. So if this is our source, we multiply the source by the time over which we accumulate particles. And we have, again, we are losing here a factor of beta before cooling becomes important, and a factor of 1 when cooling becomes important. So altogether, when we look at the ratio between electrons and protons, you see that at any given time, there is a difference of beta between these two models. And this is a prediction of the model. We should see a decreasing amount of decreasing ratio of positrons to electrons. Alas, these are the measurements. So what you see here is the predictions. This part is affected by solar modulation. And by the way, here, although this is the ratio, the solar modulation makes a difference because of the different sign of the charge. No, it's a sign dependent drift that you have in the solar wind. But yeah, but it depends on the helicity. It depends on the helicity, which one is gaining, which one is losing, which is changing on time, and it's depending on the strength of the effect depends on the modulation. So all together, this what exactly we'll see here will depend on the modulation. This part is less affected by the sun. The measurements here follow quite well what you would expect. Here there is a problem. These are the measurements before Pamela, and in principle already these measurements raised a red flag concerning the validity of the models. People suggested here some additional components, which are also used now to explain what we see here. But Pamela actually made this problem much more prominent. There is no way around.
So people understand why the model is low,
As far as I know, there is no... Nobody read it. People know?
I mean, in the paper, they do address this point in that, because previous measurements are in the
solar... Oh, what is the difference between these and these? Yeah, this is effect of solar... Claim it can be as effective up to this point, yeah. So in general, as I know, this part is not, people do not pay a lot of attention in trying to fit this part because of solar modulation. And most of the energy is going to this part, which is supposed to be representative of what we have in the ISM.
Yeah, if you look at the stars,
these ones. No, I was. No, but you don't know what is in what you start with. But you can do it only for protons, antiprotons, and I'm not sure. You just have to climb the potential, that's it. So this is the electron spectrum. What you see here is the predictions of the same model that I just have shown you for the electron spectrum. These are the measurements. As you can see, they are all over the place. But the general trend is that the electron spectrum is slightly flatter than what one would expect from the standard models. Two observations which we should which are important, which made a lot of steering. One is the Attic observation, which claims that they show a strong peak around about 500 GeV. Attic is a balloon-borne experiment. And these are the Fermi. This is the Fermi data that was published only recently. This data is showing definitely a flatter spectrum than the expectations. It is not recovering the peak shown by Attic. I would guess that most of the uninvolved people trusting Fermi better than Attic, but this is a matter of taste. I don't know. This is from what I'm hearing. So these are the observations to work with. Yeah, this is the sum of electrons positron, but if the ratio is low as measured, then there is some difference. So if you will go for only for electrons, and here the ratio is rising, you should have slightly steeper. So what are the assumptions that going to everything that I just described, to the old models, and these are unconfirmed assumptions. So we don't have any strong evidence that these assumptions are correct, except for the fact that so far it fitted most of the data. But now we start having problems. So the first one is that the uniform cosmic rays sources has a rather uniform distribution in the disk. And here, when I say uniform, I mean on intermediate scale. It's clear that they are not uniform on a parsec scale. And it's also clear, or most likely, they are not uniform on 10 kiloparsec scale. But if we are looking at half kiloparsec or 1 kiloparsec, sources are usually taken to be uniform. Not necessarily the case. Sources accelerate protons and electrons to a similar power law spectrum. There is some evidence for this point from observation if we assume that supernova remnants are the sources. Just from the observation, there is some evidence for this claim, but it's not necessary that what we see in the observation, which are the particles in the source, are also the spectrum of the particles which are escaping later to the interstellar medium. So there is some freedom here, and I will not get into it, but the standard models, when they try to fit Fermi data, usually what they are doing, they are just changing the slope of the source of the electron. So you say, okay, we have a different slope for the electron. We take, this is a free parameter. Now we can fit the data well in the standard model, only changing this assumption. Again, strong assumption, cosmic ray diffuses isotropically with a rigidity dependent way, but this diffusion is constant in time, constant in space. This is a rather strong assumption, not necessarily correct. No, I don't know about a good explanation where it comes from, except for what this is what feeds the data. But another assumption, we have the scale height. The diffusion this scale height is energy independent. So for all the particles, we have the same scale height. And all particles, once they get to the scale height, they escape. As far as I know, and you can correct me, the main support to this argument, except for the fact that it feeds the data well, is observations of different galaxies where we see a halo, which is much larger than the disk, on the order of kiloparsecs. But again, this energy independent fact is not well, it's not clearly the case. Although it sounds reasonable, but yeah. Infinity. It's not necessarily. You should have some. This is making it not continuous. You should have some continuous transition. If the transition is sharp enough, then you can use this assumption. And we don't have anything better to replace it with. So in principle, you can start playing games with changing this with height, etc., etc. These are the assumptions used.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But everything. These are the assumptions which are used when the model predictions, which I just showed you before, are calculated. Okay, so this is a correct statement. Okay, there are many different models. People did a lot of things. This is true. But this is when you hear the statement, the model do not feed the Pamela data. We have an anomaly. This is what you assume when you say the model. And Until recently.
If you look at those parallel parts of those electron observations, that's because of the fairly high potential. Well, let's take it. If you prove that you can fit the secondary primary equation pretty well, then what would always be a problem is that you can never be able to put down a function. Probably, can't forget about it, it's there.
From what maybe I read the biased paper, but from what I read, it's not such a major problem. But maybe it's because I read mostly papers of.
Okay.
As I said, I'm rather new to the field, so. Okay. Another assumption going into these models are, of course, that the positrons are secondaries. And not only that they are secondaries for cosmic ray ISM interactions outside of the regions where the cosmic rays are accelerated. If you take all these assumptions, maybe I forgot one or two, I'm going in. But if you take these assumptions, you have a discrepancy implying that at least one of these of the model assumptions are wrong, at least one, maybe more. At least one. Which one do you choose? So what are the suggested solutions? What I will do from now on, I will go back again and again to this model, to these assumptions, and we'll see what are the different choices. The most popular choice, and when I say most popular, not necessarily if I will carry a vote here, but most popular is a number of papers published, is to cross this one. If you cross this one, you say, okay, this is not the case. Positrons are produced, cosmic ray positrons are produced somewhere else where a new, yet unaccounted for, primary source for positrons. And the claim, which I, in my mind is too strong, is that the Pamela anomaly requires this. No? If you cross this assumption, this is what you get. And this type of model has two flavors. One of them is the new physics. So based on these observations, we require to revise our view of the world, introducing new physics for the decay of dark matter or annihilation. It went very well with Attic observations. So the fact that Attic have shown such a strong peak were a hint to say this is a mass of the particle. It's about 600 GeV, this is the mass of the particle. It's giving us this strong bumps, peak in the electron spectrum. It's producing positrons, very nice. Why I said the new physics, not because of the fact that dark matter annihilate or decay, this sounds quite plausible, but the models are not the models that people will predict to begin with. So if you'll go to people that did this type of model and ask before, would you expect to see a Pamela anomaly, an Attic peak, they will tell you no. And the reason is, there are two reasons. One reason is that the cross-section needed, for example, in the case of annihilation, is very large. It's much larger than what you would get just for the production of dark matter from the Big Bang. So in order to increase significantly this cross-section, as far as I know, what you need is a velocity-dependent cross-section in such a way that sigma v will be larger at lower velocity, so you will get these types of the fluxes observed. Second, the observation of antiprotons to protons are quite constraining. So I want to produce a large flux of positrons, but I don't want to produce a large flux of antiprotons. So I need my models to be, how do they call it, leptophilic? Leptophilic or hydrophobic. Depends on which way you want to look at it. But this is there is a lot of papers in this venue. The second source is not, well, I write here new, it's not really new, it's rather old, is the idea that what we see here is a contribution of pulsars. I say new because people didn't predict to see the Pamela anomaly or anything like it just from pulsars, but pulsars are major candidate for production of pairs. We know that pairs relativistic pairs are produced in pulsars. We just don't know how many of these pairs, what is the spectrum of the pairs which actually escape for the ISM. And you need, well, I don't know if this is a rather moderate or alarming, but it's not negligible, yet not too high fraction of the energy released as 100 GeV pairs. I think that you need about 10 to the 48 erg per second. Erg.
Mm-hmm.
And now, there are other models, other astrophysical models, which I'm not going to get into, but GRBs were suggested, magnetars were suggested. Okay. You have a free parameter, which is the amount of energy you release. You feed the spectrum to be as you observed, and you continue from there. Because we don't know. We don't know how much energy and what the spectrum is produced by pulsar. So you have these three parameters to feed.
So now, as you said, here it's like it's a monochromatic energy, but you mean everything about
the GeV. It's dominant by 100 GeV. Yeah, but the observations are given for about 100 to about 1,000 GeV. Of what you see in with attic, and yeah. What you see with family is between 10 to 100.
Okay, unless you put in the energy at 100 GeV, and then it's a really cooling electric population that has -2 basically, and this.
No.
That's true. Especially if you can see how many people are working on the phone or something on their
Now, the question I want to ask, do I have, in the time I don't have, is can the new observation be explained without invoking a new person? So what I will do, we will see, these are the assumptions. Actually, there are papers showing that there are no observations that directly rule out this. So it's only the combination of the observation which are ruled out, but of the assumptions which are ruled out, not these assumptions. And if we allow this to remain as is, or making some different changes here, we can get some astrophysical, hopefully motivated by what we know, solutions to the Pamela anomaly. So the first model I will discuss rather briefly, more brief than I wanted, is the model we suggested, which may or may not be correct. But what we crossed is this part. The assumption that the sources are distributed uniformly on about kiloparsec scale, and this is a well-motivated astrophysical assumption. And simply what we know about inhomogeneity in supernova remnant distribution will make the difference, assuming the supernova remnants are the sources of cosmic rays, and these are believed. I think there is no point to convince you here that the main candidate for what is for cosmic rays that we observe, at least the protons and the electrons, are supernova remnants. So the point here is the following. It's rather simple. If we have a source, a single source, now a single steady source at some distance d from Earth, just single one, and we have, this is a source spectrum. If we look at the spectrum observed on Earth, then the protons will show the same spectrum, and we take the same diffusion as before. So everything else remains the same. So the proton spectrum of the source on Earth will not be strongly affected by the fact that we have a single source, alas. The electron spectrum will be very strongly affected at the point where diffusion time equal to cooling time. We'll not see electrons at energies higher than the so they are cooling on their way to Earth. So diffusion, they just disappear, and this will be an exponential cutoff, a very strong cutoff. What about the that the source is not moving very, that the diffusion is faster. Oh yeah, sure. A steady source. This is assuming a steady source. It's not true for a single supernova, but this is true if you have a region where you have many supernova exploding all the time. Okay. Depending at what distance, but okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, steady source. Yeah, at some distance. Cooling time. If I look what happens for the positrons, then the source of the positrons are the protons in this model. The protons are rather homogeneous after the because they are spread and do not cool. So there is no exponential cutoff for the positrons. So you see, just from this steady source, unrealistic picture of a single source at some distance, we get a point where the distribution of where we expect to see up to this point, we'll see a decay, a falling ratio. From this point on, we'll see a rising ratio similar to what we have in the Pamela observations. If we'll take this source, we'll add now some scale height and allow for escape. It's not much more difficult. You can analytically simply solve the time scales and distributions you expect. And the point is that the proton age that you will observe will be the maximum between the escape time and the square root of the escape time and the diffusion time. Cooling will have, electrons will have an exponential cutoff at some point. And the positrons will not be strongly affected by the fact that we have a single a source at some distance and not uniformly distributed. Altogether, we expect to see a break, a Pamela-like feature at the point where the distribution, where the cooling time of the electrons is equal to the lifetime to the lifetime of the positron, and this is assuming that the distance of the source is equal or larger than the size, than the scale height of the system. Now, if we measure the age of cosmic rays, it's about 10 million years, at about 20 GeV or 10 GeV, and this is comparable to the cooling time of about 10 GeV electron. So in principle, in this model, if we put the source at such a distance, at a distance which is comparable to the scale height, which is about 1 kiloparsec away, we get a Pamela-like feature at about 10 GeV. And this also fit the age of cosmic rays. Sorry?
You also get a drop in the number of electrons.
You get a drop in the number of the electrons.
This is not what the data is.
Okay. This is the model. Maybe. Give me a chance. Well, supernova remnants are not distributed equally in the galaxy. In typical spiral galaxies, we see a strong concentration of core collapse supernovae in the spiral arms. There is also a population of type 1 supernovae in the disk, rather uniformly distributed. Typical ratio given from core collapse to type 1 is about a factor of 3 or so. And if we assume that they are accelerating cosmic rays in equal efficiency, then we expect to have a larger number of sources in the spiral arms. What is the distance to the spiral arms? If you look at this beautiful Wikipedia view of the galaxy, this is a sun, and there are supposed to be, based on the observations, we are not, the structure of the galaxy is not very well constrained, but it seems that there are two spiral arms, the Perseus and the Carina, and the Sagittarius Carina spiral arm, at a distance of about 1 to 2 kiloparsec from Earth. So the distance of the sources of where we expect to have an enhancement in the number of sources is of the order of a kiloparsec. Now, of course, if we take the full model, then we have an enhancement, only an enhancement of a factor of a few. We'll not have a sharp drop in the electron spectrum because the disk component will become important. And as we see, we'll see the other components which can become important. And these are nearby supernovae. So once we go to large energies, the cooling time is becoming very short. We are actually sampling a smaller and smaller volume in time and space. Once we start to sample volume which is small enough, we cannot even assume that we have a continuous population on any scale. We need to have to account for the discreteness of the sources, because at any given time we get a contribution from 1, 2, 4, but a number of a few sources, and we need to account for this discreteness. Now, if we have an impulsive injection of cosmic rays, electron at some distance to Earth, then, and at some time, then the what we observe on Earth will look similar to this to the shapes at different timescales, where this part of the spectrum are electrons that already cooled, so we have a very sharp cutoff. Too much time passed since the injection of the particles and the time that we observed. These particles didn't arrive at CS, they are still diffusing, struggling on their way to Earth. And this part of the spectrum, this is what already observed, and you see that this is going down in time, because for a given energy, the amount of particles are spreading on larger and larger volume. Since I have a fixed number of particles released at time zero during the explosion, this is going down. What you see here is a list of possible candidates in the region of about half kiloparsec away, half mega year old sources. And you can assign different output for the energies of these particles. And altogether, what you will get is this picture. We have this region can be approximated as a two-dimensional slab. We have the disk, the spiral arms. We have a disk population, a spiral arm population. We use a ratio of 4 between the arm to the disk population. Around the sun, we cut the disk and we say, okay, at this point we don't assume any more uniform disk. We actually count sources one by one based on the five sources shown before. We take the distance from the spiral arm to Earth about 1 kiloparsec. This is periodic. From this here to here, we have another spiral arm at a distance of 2 kiloparsecs. And we use a rather shallow coefficient for the diffusion, which is important to get the result that we need, which is explaining the Pamela anomaly. Altogether, what you see here is a combination of all the sources in these models, and here this is and what you have here is a contribution of the disk of the arm, which indeed fall off around 10 GeV rather sharply. The contribution of the disk, which is starting compensating for the fall off in the arm around, say, a few tens of GeVs, and the contribution of single sources. You have here a single source, second source, and a third source. I think that Geminga is the first one, which is giving us dominating the spectrum above a few hundred GeV. And what you see is a combined fit for the data for the proton. This is the Fermi data. This is the ATIC data. And this is a Pamela observations. All together, this is done in a Monte Carlo simulation of a very simple model where we just follow the propagation of the electrons. And we fit for the diffusive coefficient and the scale height. You can see that the diffusion coefficient, the scale height needed in order to get here a good agreement with the Pamela data are lower than usual, about a factor of a few lower, both in the scale height and in the diffusion. You need both of them to get for the right to get the right point where you have a decrease. You have here a turnover in the ratio. And we didn't fit for the cosmic ray age, but we get a cosmic ray age of about 14 megayears at GeV, which is consistent with the expectation of the naive model and also with the observations. And yeah. Not flat enough. No. So, there is a difference here.
Right. Well, so,
okay. This part, in order to have this increase, okay, you need a difference of about 0.2 in the spectrum of electrons and positrons. Okay? So this is a rather mild difference. You see here that this part of the data is the decay here in the proton is something like minus 3.3. For the positrons, what you get here is roughly minus 3 at this region. This is what giving you the difference. Okay, it's a very mild difference. If you go for the Fermi numbers for the slopes, as is. So Fermi says the slope is minus 3.04 for electrons. Okay? If you take this number as is, then you cannot get this feature. Okay, if you allow for the uncertainties, between the different models, for example, if you go to estimates of the slope of electrons in this part, before Fermi data, it was constrained to be minus 3.4 plus minus 0.03 by some models. Not necessarily specifically in this part, because
so you're saying with the Fermi error bars, you can indeed accommodate a little drop in the electron.
Yeah. Yeah, it's marginal. If you take the error bars at face value and you make a single power law, fit for all this part, then no. I don't think it will work all the way. You can get here a rise not up to this point. If you only fit this part and you allow here for different power laws, then you have a larger freedom. Yes?
Maybe I'm missing something, but this cosmic ray age you quote here, is the age corresponding to the diffusion coefficient that you choose?
Yeah.
Okay. So, which is the scaling with the energy of these?
E to the minus one third.
So this means
third of a protein.
About 100 GeV, it's 14 times 10, some 100 to 1/3. Yeah, so it's about 5. So it's about 3 million years.
Okay. Which is much larger than the ages of the sources you put in. Right. They are...
No. You're talking about this part?
Yeah.
No. This is age for the typical cosmic rays which are arriving from a distance larger than kiloparsec. About kiloparsec.
What about
the local sources?
Yeah.
About 100 megaparsecs, 200 megaparsecs, 300 megaparsecs.
What?
Parsecs. About a million years or a few hundred thousand years.
Which is still a factor of 10 or 50 larger than the ages of the sources itself. I can't understand how these closer sources can be responsible for, say, 100
GeV. Let's say Vela, for instance.
Vela, you cannot see Vela. Yeah, and it didn't contribute. Vela is over here. Yeah,
because...
Yeah, so you get a distance of about an age of about 300,000 years and a distance of about 400 parsecs will give you a cooling time. So this age will give you a cooling of about TeV.
But it's not the cooling, the problem.
It's the time to arrive here.
The diffusion time is of the same order of that thing, which means that basically you are only seeing particles, right? That it's almost like a delta function kind of looking.
So you say, why do we have here this part? Nearby sources. Yeah, it's a model. There is a prediction for this model. There is a prediction for this model, which is that the ratio here drops down. Here we have a contribution of nearby supernovae, so primary sources, nearby primary sources of electrons, but not of positrons, are dominant here. And therefore, this ratio must drop down at about, 100, 200, but a few hundred GeV, it should go down. On the electrons, you will see it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I don't think we can. Yeah, exactly. Well, and this conspiracy is one of the problems of the model. So if you would see like something like this, you would say, oh, yeah. But the fact that you don't see any strong feature here, and you say, well, it's a combination, it's a weakness of the model. Nevertheless, you do expect to have some combination at some point. Maybe here. So what are the measurements here? Where are they taken from? Heat. Sorry.
What are the coordinates?
I think this is heat, if I'm not mistaken. We choose one of them just in order not to fill the figure with data. But in principle, Fermi can go deeper here. Pamela. for the electrons? They didn't publish, as far as I know, they didn't publish an electron data for the electron spectrum.
Can you predict actually the difference in total electron spectrum? That's one of the crucial predictions.
For the electrons, at this part. Well, here you can probe it by Fermi, and probably Pamela will also have here some measurements. They didn't publish it yet. But if you will... Yeah, this is what I said. It's slightly above the data points you get here for Fermi, at this range.
Right, you could adjust that by saying it's not spiral some number.
Yeah, by the way, this... This... So the main idea of this simple model is not to tell you we find the solution. It's to show you how relaxing the assumption of uniform sources and using a distribution which is much more astrophysical driven can give you such effects. And maybe these effects are actually responsible to what we see. Okay? Now one thing, the fit to this part is very model dependent because we put here some energy output for the supernova which we are not sure about. It depends strongly on the diffusion coefficient, et cetera, et cetera. If you want me to get a fit which will respond also to Attic, can be done. So there is no predictive power to this part here. There are so much unrecentered in the amount of energy from this single sources that yeah, well, you can feed the data, but it doesn't tell you much.
No.
The most of the contribution from the protons is much more stronger than what you will get from local sources. A few words about two other models. The first one is a model by Pascale, and here simply Pascale relaxed this assumption. Still production of cosmic rays with ISM, but not outside of the acceleration side, but inside of the acceleration side. And the main point here is the following. Particles are produced during acceleration and then picked up by the acceleration mechanism and accelerate farther. Now, the chance to be picked up or the distance from the shock where a particle can be picked up and still continue to be accelerated depends on the energy. Larger energy, I have a larger amount of particles that I can pick up into my accelerating system, and this is assuming a diffusive shock acceleration process. So, in this case, I have the spectrum of the secondary accelerated particle is even shallower than the spectrum than the main source. It's not only that I do not lose for diffusion, I get even shallower spectrum, and this is what enables the electrons. Of course, are not dominated by this source. This is what at lower energies. This is what enables the rise at higher energies. And the point is that the grammage transversed by a particle in the acceleration site is independent of energy. But outside, it's going down with the energy. So there will be some point where I will go from an ISM-dominated interactions to, interstellar-dominated contribution to acceleration site dominated contribution, and if this is happening at the right place, you can get an explanation of the Pamela anomaly. There is a prediction. I will get to it in a second. Another solution is actually relaxing this part, saying, well, maybe the diffusion is not independent of space, and maybe there is a diffusion which is different next to the source. So we have a nested sources. We have a different diffusion next to the source than we have in the interstellar medium. And the point here is that you have an energy-dependent diffusion in the source and an energy-independent diffusion outside of the source. So at lower energies, the most of the contribution is coming from the nest, from the source. At higher energies, most of the contribution is coming from the interstellar medium. And this is, for example, the prediction. This C curve is a prediction of this nested model for the boron to carbon. So you see, it can still fit the observations, although if you will go to higher energies, it should be, you should see the discrepancy. But this allows you also to have another ingredient here, by the way, is that the observed spectrum is the source spectrum. So the spectrum of the electrons in the source would be steeper than the protons in this model. And there is no diffusion losses at high energies, or no lifetime losses at higher energies. So you can get the Pamela. This is part of the rising part, where you have a transition from local to interstellar production of sources. For just what you observe. What you observe. The spectrum that you observe is the spectrum in the source. So it's supposed to be 2.7 for the... No, because the grammage accounted here has nothing to do with the lifetime. So, can you give me 5-10 minutes before, or you can go to sleep? But it's. I just want to go quickly about the pros and the cons of the different models. The dark matter, the pro, it can explain the data. It's actually also very exciting. Maybe it's another pro. I don't know. What are the cons? It requires revolution in physics. And this is based on a rather weak assumptions in my taste. And when I have a revolution, I want a very strong evidence. If I have a small minor change, I will go with a minor evidence. And right now, I don't think we have enough evidence for going for a revolution. And we also need a non-star dot model. What are the predictions? Well, I guess you can predict almost everything. But all the predictions right now predicting a rising fraction above 100 GeV. What about the pulsar? The pros, it's a known site where relativistic pairs exist. The downside is that we don't know how many escape. We don't know what is a spectrum. So there is a lot of freedom here. Again, a prediction is a rising positron fraction above 100 GeV. I don't know if there are any other predictions. Our model, I have a bit more points because I'm more familiar with it. The pros, no new source is required. Supernova remnants are the sole source for everything. Economy is always good, to be economical. If core-collapse supernovae are the major CR sources, then the effect of this inhomogeneity of the spiral arm structure must be taken into account at some level, and it must affect at some level. And it predicts a cosmic rays age, which is comparable to the cooling time where we expect to see Pamela-like feature. There is an uncertainty here about the factor, about an order of magnitude, but roughly at the same space, at the same place. What are the problems? The main problem is that it affects basically everything. If I'm changing these assumptions, I need to redo everything, like anisotropy, like secondaries, stable secondaries, estimates of the sizes, everything. I need to redo everything. We didn't do nothing. So it was just a proof of concept. We didn't do anything. All this need be done. And the effect is not dominant over the whole range of the parameter space. So it's not something that you can say, it must be there. We must see it for everything which is observed. And as you have seen, it requires somewhat of a coincidence between the contribution from nearby sources and the contribution from spiral arm sources in order to see something which is rather flat. You don't see any strong feature in the electron spectrum. Yet you have it in the fraction of positrons. The predictions, falling positron fraction above 100 GeVs. What about the secondary production in the acceleration site? Again, one of the advantages of this model is that no new source or physics is required. if diffusive shock acceleration is the main acceleration, it must be there at some level, not necessarily the dominant one, but at some level. The effect is not dominant for all parameter space, just like in the previous models. There is a large there is a parameter allowed range of the parameter space over which this will not be the dominant contribution of electrons above about 10 GeV, and it might be an odd with a boron to carbon prediction because it's a production of boron in the site of the acceleration should also be observed, so we should see some turn up in the boron to carbon. Also, Pascal has some ideas of how to get out of this apparent disagreement. Also, the measurements are not very, very well, not very tight. The errors are not very tight. The energies at place, but at higher energies should be observed. What are the predictions? Rising positron fraction above a few hundred GeV, so it's supposed to continue and rise in this model. It should affect the antiproton spectrum above about 100 GeV. So current observation may be not constraining yet, but in the future, if we'll see a turn up in the number of antiprotons, if we'll not see it, it will be a problem for this model. If we'll see it, it will support the model. And again, a potential effect on secondary nuclei above 100 GeV. Again, if it's observed, there is one case in sub-iron elements where there is a claim that it was observed, then it will support the model. What about? I forgot to add the pros and cons for the last model. I don't about the nested model. I don't have much to say about it. I don't know about a good reason to think that we'll have the different diffusion in such a way that we'll have an energy independent diffusion. Although this might explain the anisotropy. Well, this will give us anisotropy flatness. So just the conclusions. The observed ratio require a revision in the model. Although there are well-known astrophysical effects which might account for what we see, and I think we first should explore these possibilities before we go to more exotic solutions, specifically about the inhomogeneous supernova remnant model. The realistic distribution of supernova must be included in models. It may affect things like positron and electrons. And it is the only one which is predicting a falling fraction above 100 GeV. If we observe it, at least among the models suggested so far, this is the only one which will survive. I'm sure that there will be others that will be able to follow such a prediction as well, once it is observed or not. Thanks. From the spiral arms.
Yeah,
diffused, but. Well, synchrotron radiation, you see the structure of the spiral arm in synchrotron radiation. For the GeV, I'm not sure about it, but yes, you will be able to see.
Thank you.